winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Not a lot of people saw the political rise of Donald Trump coming, but Chris Arnotti did. The Hudson Valley resident sat down with our Casey Seiler in our New York Now studio earlier this year to discuss Trump's popularity in rural America.
The photographer and journalist Chris Arnotti has a unique resume. He received a PhD in physics and then spent 20 years as a trader on Wall Street. He left that career in 2012 to focus on documentary photography, specifically a project entitled Faces of Addiction, which took a hard look at the heroin epidemic in the South Bronx. His more recent series in the British newspaper The Guardian, titled Pride and Poverty in America, examines the economic malaise that serves as the backdrop to recent political trends. His recent visit to the University at Albany gives us a chance to talk to him about what he's learned about the nation's divides. Chris Arnotti, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote just before Election Day, and I'm going to quote you here, that then candidate Donald Trump was, quote, exposing a divide between those with good education and those without, a version of the schoolroom, front row kids versus back row kid. I mean, what exactly does that mean? Does that accurately sum up how you saw Trump's effort?
In large part, yeah. I think I said the largest divide in this country, what Trump has exposed, in my opinion, was the largest divide in this country beyond race, and race is still the largest divide, is education. You know, I spent a lot of time traveling across the country, visiting different communities, and I could tell you within 5 minutes and going into town whether or not I had a elite institution, educational institution or not. I could tell you if I was in a neighborhood near a college or not. And what I started realizing was that people who have what I call the front row kids, to use an analogy, the people who have elite educations, myself, maybe you,
yeah,
tend to have a very different worldview from people who may not have that type of education. And I think you saw both before the election and then you saw, as a result of the election, that Trump really resonated with people, especially those primarily whites who don't have an elite education, who what I call the back row kids. And I think that divide is probably our most salient division in the country.
You also note that you know, it became simple. If I wanted to talk to a community overwhelmingly supporting Trump, I would go to a white town or neighborhood nearest the rusting factory surrounded by razor fence. So it's education, but it's definitely also economic potential, what people see on the horizon when they think about their economic future.
Right, they correlate highly. In general, you know, people who work with their hands, not their muscles.
Right.
I mean, their muscles, not their brains, is
yeah.
what I say.
Yeah.
But you end up getting what I call back row communities where the overwhelming ethos, the overwhelming worldview is dominated by people who may not have an elite education. And in those communities, what used to hold the community together was the factory, the jobs. And those jobs have left in large part. And, you know, so it is very much economic, and they're very correlated. But it's not just economic, it's beyond economics. It's about the way we live and the way we think and the way what we value.
When you worked on Wall Street, I assume, did you live in Manhattan?
Brooklyn, but close.
Okay, right, close enough. And but definitely, I think you would probably say Brooklyn, even now, or definitely now, is a little bit more of a front row.
Oh, my neighborhood
community.
Is definitely front row. It's Brooklyn Heights.
Okay, and now you live in New Paltz. So
I live in New Paltz.
To bring it down, well, certainly you've written this as it's a condition that obtains all over the country. Certainly in New York, we see that. I can remember when I was at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, talking to people about whether or not New York is, in a way, kind of a microcosm for this election, because you have the elitist of the elites, and you also have areas that are up against it that are absolutely the rusty razor wire fences that you've seen.
New York is interesting. It's one of the things when I tell people, and I spend a lot of time traveling all across the country, when I tell people I'm from New York, they all assume I'm from New York City,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they can't imagine that there's a New York beyond New York City. But in fact, some of the strongest despair I've seen in this country, and some of the most strongest Trump supporters I've seen in this country has been in New York State, primarily from here, Albany, towards Buffalo, along that corridor, Utica. in particular. That sort of Western New York and upstate New York has I think very much similar to what you see in Ohio and what you see in Pennsylvania, that sort of, you know, frustration with the system that resulted, in my opinion, in Trump getting elected, is very strongly, very, very much on display here in New York.
And those are, of course, areas that I'm just thinking back to a year ago when we had the Democratic primary. Those were the areas where Bernie Sanders did best. And then, of course, when you move forward to the general election, those were exactly the areas where Trump did best. That kind of the southern tier, the western, the non-urban western parts of New York as well.
Anything away from a major educational center.
Right,
So, you know, when you look at if you look at an arrow map of New York, like where Trump outperformed Romney, mm-hmm. It really was, you know, anything that didn't have a SUNY or wasn't New York City.
Yeah. You've also thought about the phenomenon of the more affluent Trump supporters. And you note that you suggested kind of a part of their appeal was those folks showing solidarity for those, as it were, in the back row.
That's right. It's you know, it's basically people, you can be wealthy and still be in a back row community. You might be somebody who owns three tire stores, or you might be somebody who is a lawyer in that town, but you've maybe stayed in your town. And, you know, you have been impacted by the decline of that town. And so you're just as impacted. And, you know, the congregants in your church, your customers, if you're the people who work for you, are people who have been very severely impacted by the economic malaise in a lot of these towns. So you yourself have been infected.
I just saw an interview you recently did with Brian Stetler on CNN where he asked, he's of course their media guy, asked if the fact that if this was missed by the mainstream media, this kind of groundswell of support for Trump, and of course that's a long discussion as to whether, you know, anytime you talk about the mainstream media, you're talking about a lot of different outlets, but you say this is a media problem, that whether it's whether it's a city newspaper or national outlets, this is a strata of our society that is not getting covered, not being understood as well as it should be.
Yeah, the only reason I started writing about Trump in politics was because it wasn't being covered. So I did this journey of about 175,000 miles on my car in 2 years, documenting poverty and addiction across the United States, and I ended up seeing where I was going, a lot of support for Trump and a lot of anger with the system. I'd say not just support for Trump, but anger for the system. Anger at the status quo that wasn't being reported in the newspapers. So I'd spend my days, you know, in these very, very rough neighborhoods talking to people who were very angry. And then I'd go home. I'd go to I'd look at my computer at night, sit in McDonald's looking at my computer and seeing an entirely different story being broadcast by the media. And that kind of compelled me to start writing about politics, because what I was seeing out in the country wasn't at all what was being written, especially in the elite media. I'd say the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. Local papers got it, by and large, but the kind of larger media outlets didn't get it. And that's kind of the only reason I really started writing about politics, because, you know, my focus was addiction, was that the very, very first, it was actually in New York State, the very first Trump voter I met was probably, I don't know, 4 days after he announced. Mm-hmm. And I was going on this 20,000 mile trip. It ended up being 20,000 miles, 6 weeks, where I went around the country asking people about the American dream. And the very, very first person I met was, I believe it was Route 17, in a small town near Binghamton. Mm-hmm. And he was a mechanic. And I said, oh, just, you know, I did my interview with him. He said the American dream was dead, blah, blah, blah. Which became a theme across the trip. And I said, oh, by the way, who are you voting for? He goes, oh, Trump. And this was, you know, I wasn't taking Trump seriously. Nobody was taking Trump seriously. This was just a week after he announced, or 4 or 5 days after he announced, when he was a laughing stock. And from then on that trip, everybody I spoke to, Trump, 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 Trump.
You wrote, getting back to your work on addiction, drugs are popular because drugs work. They allow people in pain whom society has rejected a way to integrate into a community that does work for them. It seems that in both of the big topics that you've taken on, it's this question of community, the aspiration to join and feel like one is at home.
Very much so. I think the biggest thing I learned over the last 4 years is people want a community. I always say they want to be valued. They want to be a valued member of something larger than themselves. They want to feel included. They want to feel like they have meaning. And people get that in very different ways. The front row kids, you know, myself and you know, people who have PhDs and successful bankers and lawyers, we tend to get that from our careers. We get kind of our status, our feeling of inclusion comes from our jobs. In these other communities, that's not the case anymore. In general, people stayed where they are because they valued their local connections. They valued the place they grew up in. They valued the, you know, it's as trite as, I don't think, I mean, it's as for them as meaningful as I value the land I came from. And, you know, we front row kids kind of look at that as trite, and that's not. That's a really meaningful thing, and that's been devalued. The churches in these towns, the whole networks of support have just kind of fallen apart, and that's made people feel really kind of like they're on the out.
In its place, in a lot of ways, is a kind of social media form of connection. For, you know, not everybody, of course, can afford the kind of connectivity that I think you would say the front row kids do, but what certainly I have seen with a lot of Trump supporters and a great deal of people in the working class, the lower class, is that what has swept in has been the kind of online connectivity that is sort of a different sort of community and maybe not always the most healthy one.
Yeah, I think, you know, the online hasn't really filled the role that I think people expect it to fill.
Which is like a digital town square.
Yeah,
or something.
I mean,
like that.
You know, people want, you know, I've written a lot about how I spend a lot of time at McDonald's, and I spend a lot of time at McDonald's because when you go into McDonald's in any town, you can go to any McDonald's and you'll see an old man group, or mm-hmm. sometimes it's retired. You know, they give themselves people just sit around drinking coffee together.
Yeah. In Canada, it's Tim Hortons.
Okay, and they're extraordinarily important to people are there. This is what they do every day. And people are finding connections there. And it's kind of like people really, really want to find connections. They want community. And they want community so much that they're forming it in McDonald's. And I think that absence of community or our kind of not valuing community as much as we once did has made a lot of people feel really kind of ejected. And I think that sense of feeling ejected, sense of feeling kind of not included, is why you get a lot of addiction. And these same communities, you know, they're suffering from heroin epidemics.
Can you tell when you approach someone, the pictures you shoot are remarkable. I find them to be very respectful of the subject, which you can't always find sometimes in documentary projects like yours. When you approach somebody, can you tell fairly quickly whether or not that person is going to open up to you?
I always let things just evolve. Some of the best photos I've gotten and some of the best stories I've gotten and some of the best, for me, certainly some of the most meaningful interactions I got are people who from the outside look like they wouldn't want to let me in. Mm-hmm. But I go into any interaction not wanting to get anything out of it other than just engaging a person on their terms. And if they let me take a picture, that's even fantastic, that's even better. But I don't go in with that expectation, and that kind of helps. But I think the lesson I've learned from this is, and a lot of people ask me this question, is you'll be surprised with how many people are willing to tell you their story if you just listen.
Who do you think of as being kind of the precursors of this kind of work? I mean, surely there's, you know, Studs Terkel, who of course was famous for kind of his oral histories that he ended up rendering in prose, fantastic Chicago radio personality. John Gunther, you know, not quite a century ago, undertook this kind of survey of America at a certain point in time. I mean, who else were you thinking of when you embarked on this?
I haven't really, I haven't looked at the literature that much. I kind of just did this as kind of because I was driven to do it. And at some level, I intentionally haven't looked because I don't want it to corrupt how I'm doing it. I don't want to do it and say, oh, I should have done it that way, I should have done it this way. I just kind of let things evolve. In terms of photography, it's been the same thing. I feel like if you spend too much time reading other people's stuff, although they did great stuff, it messes up your mind.
Yeah, right.
It gets you all confused. You know, I just want to do what I want to do.
All right, well, stay away from the names I just mentioned, please. Chris Arnotti, thanks a lot. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
A reminder, you can stream any of our past programs on our website, nynow.org. You can also play our podcasts here, as well on iTunes or any other place you listen to them. Longtime viewers of our program will know how much Governor Cuomo has touted the resurgence of the city of Buffalo, particularly Canal Side. But while some of the landmarks near the water have come back to life, one of its most beloved, just up the road, is still waiting and has been for decades. Two miles away from Buffalo's Canal Side stands another landmark representing Buffalo's illustrious past. But in contrast to the celebrated revival going on along the Inner Harbor, the 17-story Central Terminal train station continues to waste away. A far cry from its birth in the Roaring Twenties. Back then, Buffalo needed a train station to match its booming economy. So in 1927, work started on the city's east side, and in the summer of 1929, Central Terminal was born, a massive Art Deco-style architectural wonder that Buffalonians could be proud of. But the timing couldn't have been worse. Just 4 months later, the stock market crashed, initiating the Great Depression. The rise of the automobile didn't help either. It enjoyed a bit of a renaissance during World War II, but the number of locomotives and travelers steadily declined. Finally, on October 28, 1979, at 4:10 in the morning, the last passenger train pulled out of the terminal.
The demand just wasn't there. Even during the 60s and the early 70s, large portions of the building were going unutilized and were basically just mothballed to the point that the concourse, there's temporary walls across it, so you would just come in and out the exit, proceed directly to your train. People weren't utilizing the waiting rooms, the ticket facilities, like originally intended.
As a college student, I was coming home on many midnight trains from the Midwest and arriving in the Central Terminal, at least my first 2 years. Then they closed it, and I remember thinking, wow, what are they going to do with this building?
That's a question that is still being asked today. After passenger service stopped, the building changed hands a number of times. Anything of value was either sold or stolen. The once proud building was now abandoned. Finally, in 1997, a group called the Central Terminal Restoration Corporation was created and took over the building for $1 plus back taxes. The goal? To somehow rehabilitate this Western New York icon.
When the organization took over, we've removed cars, washers, dryers, refrigerators, to the point there was so much debris on this concourse floor that it was close to 3 foot deep, that one of the pilasters fell, or one of the column capitals off the pilasters fell, and hit the ground and didn't even break. I mean, that's how much padding there was of just garbage in here.
After time, volunteers were able to clear the concourse, and they decided to see if anyone had any interest in coming back inside the old place.
The first time we opened the building for a tour, the line was down to the end of the driveway to the circle for people looking to get back in. And when we first opened and started doing tours, obviously tours were limited to the limited space that had been cleaned up.
This clock is the actual original clock that stood at the center of the terminal.
So since then, every year we try to add another space, you know, and it's not just the removal of the trash, it's the stabilization. If there is any, you know, abatement or any environmental concerns, all the areas that are open to the public have been tested and cleared. And so there's a lot of steps to being able to open up a new space.
we got the chance to see parts of the Central Terminal not shown on a regular tour. At times, it felt like we were walking inside the remnants of the Titanic. Long, darkened hallways, debris on every floor, and the rusted remains of what used to be a robust operation. And quite possibly, the best view of downtown.
People in Buffalo love this building. I heard so many stories when I was working on this about, you know, people whose parents had met there, or people who remembered going there as a child and being enchanted, you know, with the trains and stuff. And I guess on the face of it, it seems so simple, like this is a beloved building and why can't it be fixed? But once you kind of dig under the surface, there are so many problems which don't all have easy answers.
Charlotte Keith works for the Investigative Post. While reporting on a story about the terminal, she found infighting among board members was stalling potential investments.
A real kind of crisis moment came when one of the board members, who is a developer, made a cash offer for a very dilapidated section of the building. And for one reason, one thing led to another, and it kind of fell through. And I think a lot of board members felt that was kind of the sticking point because they had this real chance to make progress and it slipped away.
Paul Lang is a local architect and the head of the Restoration Corporation. While he agrees there have been some missed opportunities, he says what concerns him most is sustainability.
Maybe I had a different viewpoint of it than a lot of the board members because I'm kind of younger than the majority of the board. Like, I'm the one that might still be involved 20 years down the road when this is now a nightmare because the relationships haven't been worked out. You know, the initial reward and gain was there. I don't want to be the one that everybody's coming back to later going, how'd you screw up this?
With a new board in place, the nonprofit put out an RFP this year in hopes of attracting new partners.
We went through a lot of tours with local developers. We actually had surprisingly interest from outside the region as well. And because of that interest alone, we've been able to garner some more political support and foundation support within the area, which is only kind of further emboldening us as far as being able to move forward.
And that's been one of the toughest obstacles, getting political support. The cost to fix the 86-year-old building is estimated to be in the tens of millions. Another thing Central Terminal has going against it is the neighborhood. Only 2 miles away from the heart of the city, the distance seems much greater.
The old real estate slogan of location, location, location is significant. If that building, that structure, were anywhere closer to downtown or in downtown, it would have been redeveloped long ago, just like Union Station in Washington or any of the other major old train terminals in the downtown centers. Its location and its enormity make it a very difficult prospect for redevelopment.
We are kind of out on an island, essentially. We're in a, you know, impoverished neighborhood for the most part that doesn't have a lot of political support behind it because you don't have inhabitants that stay here and vote.
Believe it or not, trains still go by. In fact, multiple times a day.
It's a very, very active line. We've actually seen an increase. It used to only be a handful of trains a day. Now it's, you can probably hear it in the background now, it's, you know, regular occurrence. If we were to give them a reason to stop here again, or, you know, they could easily stop, and it's not like you have to build new lines, right? They're literally right there.
Central Terminal falls in the district of State Senator Tim Kennedy, who says the progress the city has made in restoring some of the history by the water could potentially make its way to the East Side neighborhood.
I believe with time and as Buffalo builds this momentum and private equity is invested in the city, there are great cultural centers and economic centers of the past and our great history, like the Central Terminal, that new life will be breathed into. And there are great preservationists that have helped to keep that history alive and hold it for those investors. And I believe it's only a matter of time, and I believe probably sooner than later, we'll have that critical investment into the Central Terminal that we rightfully need and it rightfully deserves.
Paul Lang certainly hopes so. How much does he love this place? Enough that he proposed to his future wife atop the old building, and he can't think of a better example of his city's resilience.
The timeline of the building kind of goes along very nicely with Buffalo's timeline as far as rise, fall, kind of slow rebirth. And it just has all those features that are very Buffalonian. There's a very, you know, rustic, do it ourselves, kind of to hell with you, we'll make it work ourselves kind of attitude that go along with the building.
An apt description of not only the building, but the city and the people who live here in Western New York. One last reminder, you can catch up on all the political news on our website, nynow.org. It's where you can follow links to us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll find a link to the Capital Confidential blog while you're there. It can also be found at timesunion.com. And that will do it for us this week on New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.